Hey, everybody, welcome to This Week in Pre-IPO Stocks podcast. With me, I got Nick Fusco, CEO of 8View, a pre-IPO secondary market pricing company, and Evan Cohen, co-founder of Vincent.com, a media company focused on alternative investments. All right, guys, Schroders Asset Management just marked up their Revolut investment, right? So Revolut's $25.7 billion is where Schroders just marked them. Their last round was in July of 2021 at $33 billion. My numbers have their implied secondary market valuation at $19.1 billion. So this is a pretty big increase, right? It's 35% above kind of where the secondary market has it at. Revolut is $1.87 billion in 2023 revenue. So it's like a 10x multiple. Schroders is at 13.7, right? But really the question I want to have for you guys, because I'm not really seeing mutual fund marks impact the secondary market. So when I go to trade or I'm talking with people, like folks aren't saying Fidelity has this company marked here or Schroders has this company marked there, right? But I think it's a really powerful place. So like maybe Nick, I could start with you, right? Like what do you think about these mutual fund companies or institutions marking positions? And do you think that that has any kind of impact on how the secondary market trades at all? Like what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think it goes both ways. So when we saw the large declines in 2022, a lot of what we observed in the secondary market was a leading indicator of mutual fund marks to follow. And that was when, I mean, some of the big funds were taking 30 or 40 or sometimes 50% haircuts over the span of a quarter, which was outrageous. You know, that wasn't really tracking the risk appropriately. But conversely, on the way up, we are seeing that some of the mutual fund marks are a good indicator for where the secondary will snap back to, or they actually present a more foundational number where the secondary market likes to gravitate to. Not dissimilarly, but not as profoundly as a primary round. So, I mean, we talked about this with Discord a few weeks ago, but usually when the fund marks start coming up prior to the secondary, it's a good sign. We also saw that with Databricks as the mutual fund marks sometimes can also be predictive because of the amount of information they may get about primary rounds that are going to occur. So when we see a narrowing of mutual fund marks, sometimes that's a predictive indicator of a round or some sort of activity that's going to happen.
See, like that to me, I feel like that's like a hack. Like to your point around data rights, like most people in the secondary market don't have any kind of information rights, right?
That's right.
But if you're a mutual fund company, you're required by the SEC to mark to market, and then they have to disclose that on a quarterly basis. So to your point, if they're using the information rights and that's influencing the mark, I think that's like a hack, right?
Well, yeah, I'll just comment on that because it might not be influencing the mark. It just might be they have more information about what may be occurring. So if they understand that the company is going to be doing a capital raise and that they're part of those discussions or they're in the room or they have the kind of documentation to show for it, I don't know that that's a hack. It's more of, hey, we're inside, we understand, and they're doing what is their fiduciary responsibility to shareholders to just get
it. I'm talking about guys like me. It's a hack for me. Like, hack. That's great data, right?
Cheat sheet for you as an investor. Absolutely.
It's a great mark. I think it's, I mean, Evan, what do you think? I mean, I know you bought and sold the stuff, right? Did you ever look at mutual fund marks before pulling the trigger on anything?
Absolutely. And I know that 8View definitely has this information and we,
yes, they do.
We definitely find that very valuable. At the end of the day, remember, like these mutual funds, they have a fiduciary responsibility to their investors. They also have a legal requirement or a compliance requirement to provide what they believe are accurate mark to markets of the assets they hold for.
Right.
And so at the end of the day, I actually generally find these funds to be relatively conservative. So it's pretty understandable to sometimes they're lagging, but they often are conservative because they have that fiduciary responsibility and they earn management fees on those funds that they're holding. So I think it's a great data point. Historically, that data has been very hard to find. We are seeing service providers today, 8View being one of them, where you can really get that data, which helps you suss out where the market value is going. And yeah, to Nick's point, sometimes these firms have information rights, which allow them to understand better the unit economics of the business. They might have some insight into whether a company is going to potentially fundraise in the future and what that valuation might be. So I think if you are investing in the secondary market and you want to really do your due diligence, absolutely. I think that if there's a company that has an institutional investor like this where you can get that data, it's absolutely essential to use when trying to decide if you think you're getting a good deal or not.
Yeah, look, I think the best price is like a primary round or a tender offer. That's like a rock solid. This is what the company's worth, right? A 409A is good, right? And for those that don't know, that's like if you have a employee stock options plan every year, the IRS wants you to value the company, right, for stock option purposes. So that's another kind of interesting thing to look at. But I think these mutual fund marks are really compelling. What caught my eye on this one, and this is why I wanted to bring it up with you guys, is that it was higher than the secondary market, right? And I do agree with you, Evan. Like usually these folks are conservative. I've ran registered investment funds before, so it's no joke. You have to get super dialed in on how you mark that, right? It is very thoughtful mark. And you're right, it is conservative because your fees are getting assessed on that. So you want to be thoughtful about it. That is, when that number is higher than where the secondary market's at, that's like an eyebrow raise for me.
Well, I would actually argue that it's the best data that you can use to price these companies. Because sometimes like a primary round, that might be an inflated valuation by a venture fund that's not doing their due diligence properly or wants to mark up their own book because they have an investment in a prior round. Sometimes you see the tender offers again, like it's also, that's much more supply and demand driven, meaning like if there's someone who wants to buy at what price is someone willing to pay? And I know, Aaron, you're a big believer in the free open markets often determine the valuations of these things. I find the information from institutional investors or mutual funds, when they do their valuation, it's much more data centric. And I find that to be a better barometer of where you can find true valuation. I think it's really valuable.
So like with these pre-IPO stocks, though, a lot of the companies that would buy them when they IPO are like the Schroders and the Fidelities. They're mutual fund companies, right? They would buy them potentially in the IPO. So does that, you think, give it even more weight for these companies that we kind of all look at, these late stage venture backed companies, pre-IPO stocks, right? Is it even more important what a Schroders thinks this thing is actually worth? Because if they're doing the roadshow and the bankers are talking to all these guys, they're like, I think it's worth this. And they're like, you know, jockeying a back and forth on what the price per share should be. I mean, that's like really telling, I think. No?
Right. I think, I was going to go slightly different, but let's hit on that. I mean, the life cycle of a lot of these companies would be they have high profile angels that could catapult them into getting top VCs. Then eventually they get larger or steadier hands for the Series A, the B, the C. The companies we're now looking at have raised in excess of $100 million. So you start to want to have them be in the hands of your Schroders, Fidelities, T. Rowe Prices of the world, who kind of bring them through to the IPO process and want to balance out that portfolio. So a lot of these can have up to 15% of these stocks in that. So we want to start looking at these private companies that do look public. But one thing that we're realizing we did the last third of the show last week about was companies staying private longer. So you may see a differential on where a Schroders, a Fidelity, a BlackRock will mark, if they have only preferred, right? Versus a mix of common and preferred. So we track both independently for those mutual fund marks, because if a name like Revolut may see, well, first off, it's a substantial amount in 00 SPVs, but a lot of those are based on common shares. Mm-hmm. And if there's not a high expectation of IPO, the lower the probability of the IPO or the longer it will take to get there, the wider that differential will be between the preferred stocks that a Schroders would have in most cases and what we observe in the secondary market, which would be a nice mix. So there are kind of two factors at play there. That's why you kind of need all information from every single angle. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or enough. You should get an investment advisor to help you do it, because some of the information is hard to get.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay. Let's move on. So Rippling and Ramp both had raises this past week, right? The secondary market was trading below where these guys came through in this kind of subsequent round. So congratulations to people that just made trades, because they're going to see a nice, like, quick pop here. So, but my question is, like, why are we still seeing a suppressed secondary market for some of these names, right? Like the Qs have come back quarters ago, right? It hasn't happened quite yet in the secondary market for some of these like more SaaS companies, fintech companies. They're still trading at like massive discounts. So this was telling to me when I saw these companies come through at higher marks than the last rounds. And just to hit on this quick. So Rippling, they raised $870 million at a $13.4 billion post-money valuation. $200 million was for the company. $670 million was for existing shareholders to trade. I thought that was interesting, right? Their last primary round was at $11.8 billion in March of 2023. Their secondary market was at 10.7 billion. So 10.7 billion to 13.4, right? Ramp was 150 million raised at a $7.6 billion post-money valuation. Their last round was at 5.8 billion in December of 2023. And their secondary market was at 6.7 billion. So 6.7 to 7.6. So we're talking 14% pop for Ramp and a 25% pop for Rippling. I mean, not for nothing, 25% pops, like, that's a lot, I think. So any thoughts on why the secondary market, maybe Evan, we can start with you. Any thoughts on why secondary market's still at a discount, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, let's just touch on the fact that both of these companies are B2B software companies in the financial services business. And remember who their customer is. Their customers are typically startups, and the startup ecosystem, the funding has been more challenging. The markets have certainly compressed the flow of funds. Companies have cut down their costs. And I imagine that they're starting to see some deceleration in the growth of those areas. And maybe that's reflective of the momentum that the valuation of the companies have. On the flip side, both of those companies are run by stellar CEOs who mm-hmm. have raised from some of the best investors ever. They're both repeat founders with exits under their belt. They're both very well-respected companies, and they actually compete with each other, which is quite interesting as well. I think something to note here is that these are two competitive forces that ultimately will come head-to-head in the spend management category and probably other categories as well. And it's an expensive space, right? There's only so many customers you can go after. And I think that what you're seeing here is valuations are increasing because of the respect for the founders, the companies, and the progress they've made. I think both of these companies took their medicine when valuations were crashing in 22 and the markets were somewhat frozen and their customer bases were starting to sort of dry up. And just one last piece relative to what we just talked, there's a lot of common equity out there right now, which could impact the valuation that you're seeing trades happen. Because I know that there's been inside sellers, which both of these companies might have IPOs, but they also could be acquired because financial services are great target companies for larger financial service businesses. And so, you know, if they get acquired, the pref will definitely have some exposure over the common. And that might explain why the valuations are not raising in the secondary as much as they are in the primaries.
Nick, what do you think? What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, all good thoughts from Evan. I think it's rather interesting. We can overlay the valuations on these. And you've actually seen Ramp largely trading at a discount relative to Rippling throughout the course of its history. So it's very cool to see that kind of continue. One thing to note is also Ramp took a pretty considerable down round when Rippling didn't. They did really the top of the market pretty much almost New Year's Eve on 2021 was their C3 round, which is around just under 9 billion. So it's great to see it's really coming back, kind of up towards those levels, which is great. But the main thing takeaway, you're starting to see these companies look like they can trade more like public instruments because, I mean, you're getting some charting capabilities built in with the way these are fluctuating and moving kind of in lockstep with each other. And you can see the value differential and you want to factor in kind of the enterprise value to revenue ratios. So I don't know. I'm just getting excited. And I was looking at the charts while listening to Evan. So I think these are really showing a lot more data today than we've ever had exposure to for any investor that's kind of looking for that diversification.
Yeah. I mean, one company we haven't even talked about, but Brex also was in that category. We know they've certainly taken a massive cut in valuation as they've seen their business sort of come to a slowing down or even stall. So, you know, I were curious to see what the data would look like if you overlaid Brex on top of that. I think that trend is probably even more apparent.
Yeah, I got to tell you though, I'm not sure if business is slowing for all these guys. I mean, Ramp, for example, their revenue is up 4x from 2022. It's funny, man. Like, so Klarna was the same way, right? Klarna took it on the chin. They had like cash flow problems, right? But they are roaring back. They're kicking butt. I get the sense with all the data that we can get through like 8View, PitchBook, other sources, media sources, et cetera, you know, the general theme that I'm kind of seeing, and this is very qualitative, is that all of these companies are doing like very well. Like the sense that I get is that the companies are kicking butt. They're performing. They're getting new customers, right? but I'm not seeing them in the valuations.
Okay. So, that's where I'm just like,
when is it going to come? And it looks like it's coming for Rippling and Ramp, but I have to imagine, like, I've been talking with investors for a year and a half now about how these companies have depressed valuations. And I think that there's room for them to run, and it hasn't ran yet.
So you know, though, Aaron, you're probably the perfect person to talk about this. So Rippling and Ramp, they have some overlap in their business, specifically in the spend management, but Rippling is a PEO business. So they are certainly much more HR and operations compliance focused. Ramp's business is built on interchange of debit. And you know that the government has been trying to crack down on interchange fees, trying to limit the amount of revenue that these companies can make on the debit line. And so I am imagining that if you're an investor looking at the forecast of how this business can grow, you know that there's a massive headwind on the regulatory side that could play into their revenue numbers if they don't expand into other areas, which I imagine you would know better than almost anybody I know.
Yeah. I mean, interchange is a tough business. That being said, business interchange is much better than consumer interchange, which is, so for these guys are doing business interchange. So that's much better and a lot less regulation for that matter. But there's something, I'm just continually watching and very interested in why we're still seeing such a depression. And I'm just, you know, I wonder if it's just going to take companies doing primary rounds to get the secondary to kind of come back up. Like naturally everyone wants a deal when you come in to buy. So you're going to try and push down that price. And if you got people who are all jammed up, employees and whatnot, and you're always pointing back to that last primary round, or everything's not going well, or, you know, whatever it might be, everything else is down, so you should be down, and not enough companies have come up and done the primary round, then I get it. If you want to get out, you just got to take what the market's willing to give you. But I mean, better for me. I'm a buyer, so I want prices to be lower. But
would you think those companies are IPO targets or acquisition targets?
I don't know who's going to IPO anymore. I got to be honest. Like, everybody's staying private for longer. I mean, I'm out there pounding the drum on this. Like, there's a private stock market now. I think people are going to end up going full circle. I think people will buy and sell all in the private markets, and they'll have like a 5-10 year investment horizon. Like, Rippling's a perfect example. $670 million of existing investors trading. The company only needed $200 million. So there's plenty of liquidity out there, and people who want to sell, they can sell in a very like structured institutional way, right? So I mean, that's where it's so interesting to talk about like these valuations, and I think like you talk about being fiduciaries, like price discovery, valuations, like really digging in on this stuff and understanding it. I think you got to do it because there's some dislocation out there.
Exactly. And I think you have a nice point there that we were just talking about the differential between preferred and common. But let's say that you get to that point where you're doing some of these tenders, and the tender substantially outweighing the total volume of what capital is being raised. And eventually, maybe there's not much raising that even needs to occur.
Right.
That threshold between common and preferred will just shrink back up because the companies will just continue to perform. As long as the growth numbers don't go horribly wrong, I mean, the expectation that valuation will continue going up, and there you have it. I mean, there's a lot more infra today for all those things you mentioned for best act price discovery. Everyone's going to know where the price is to strike fair NAVs, and it will be a much more comfortable and seamless operation. And it almost makes me think back to like the syndicated loans market that's pretty still antiquated with many weeks of settlement and all that through the process. But at the same time, the market is massive. So why not have this here?
$670 million is a lot of money.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, and like, it's like every couple of weeks now we hear another Stripe does one. Canva just closed theirs, right? $600+ million. I mean, like, it's like every other month, there's like another like $500 to $1 billion plus like round happening. We're just, existing shareholders are selling. That's liquidity.
Right.
Full stop.
Yep.
Right. I know it's not like opening up your Schwab account and typing in a ticker and letting it rip on a sell order. Right. But that is liquidity.
Right.
It really is.
And there's no reason why some of these private companies might not just start paying dividends out at a later stage in their life. I mean, I forget what company it was, but it made the press a couple weeks ago because the private company had paid out on a dividend. That's so unheard of, right, in the private markets. for these styles.
Well, ByteDance is doing buybacks.
Right.
I mean,
these are all great for the infra. I love it.
Yeah. Okay, cool. All right. Last topic, Mistral. AI, large language model in Europe. AI, like competitor with OpenAI. So these guys went to market in December at a $2 billion valuation. Now they're raising at $5 billion. So
obviously.
That's what you do
after 4 months. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So like $2 billion to $5 billion. It's a $3 billion increase in valuation in 4 months' time. They have just started making revenue and they're at a $22 million in annualized revenue. So here's the question. That's a bananas. I don't even know what that math is. What's $5 billion over $22 million? It's a very big number from a revenue multiple perspective. This is intense, right?
Yeah.
This AI thing is intense. These valuation models are very high, right? This one to me really caught my eye because like OpenAI is out there with a lot of market share, right? And Anthropic's out there with a lot of market share. Like how many more companies are going to come out and get, 1,000x, 500x, 100x revenue multiples? Let's start with you. Like, what do you think about Mistral? Do you know it? Do you know the company? Or have any thoughts? And in particular, what's this? I'll see if I don't break my calculating what the revenue multiple is.
You're in excess of 200, right?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I don't really know the company, so I don't have a great amount of commentary here. This doesn't seem unfathomable. Compared to other companies that we're seeing in the AI sector, even when you look at the cohort of what Y Combinator has been pushing money into and a lot of what you're just seeing from a presence on VC Twitter, money is just pouring into AI hand over fist. So if you have that competitive edge, it sounds like they must. A bit mind blowing, but in the context of the broader market, I understand that's things are going. Yeah.
Evan, what do you think,
man? Evan does his homework better than I do. So,
well, I mean, I happened to be in Paris when they announced the $2 billion round. And as you both know, I was a venture investor in Paris. So I'm pretty well aware of Mistral. And I agree with everything both of you have said around this market is just bananas and the valuation probably is ridiculous. That said, Europe has a very different mindset when it comes to big tech and when it comes to data privacy than the United States does. And there is a lot of skepticism of the way that OpenAI and Google and Amazon handle American data, which is why you have seen cloud providers outside of AWS and Google Cloud do well in Europe, because they have very specific rules, GDPR compliant rules, and where how data can be used within the EU.
Good point.
Separately, there's a lot of European money, investor money, venture money, institutional money, that would love to see a European winner in this market. There's a lot of envy about the success of the American tech ecosystem has worked. France historically has had a very great engineering culture. I mean, Airbus is a great example of French innovation, but they've invented a lot of really great technology, but the overall culture around startups has never been really prevalent while the United States has succeeded so much. And now they see a great opportunity to lure back talent from the West Coast and from the United States to invest in AI. Xavier Niel, who is one of the biggest French entrepreneurs of the last 3 decades, is a big backer of this. So is Eric Schmidt.
And
the government, the French tech, is putting a lot of money behind this as well. So it doesn't necessarily surprise me to see them raising money again and seeing an up round. They have a strategic partnership with NVIDIA to get H100s and to get GPUs. So that will give them some competitive edge in terms of being able to provide compute to Europe. So I think that it's kind of what we would have expected, to Nick's point, of an AI company in this cycle getting the up round and the hype. And I'm not surprised they're able to lure capital in, especially from institutional EU venture investors or institutional funds who want or have a mandate to invest in European companies. Just makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So no, that's not surprising. Said. Yeah.
Yeah, that's well said. The EU just passed these AI laws. So they have AI specific regulation now, and Mistral does their solution adheres to those regs. So to your point, right, like there may be some US companies or other companies in the world that may not want to dial it in quite yet on that type of regulation. So I could see that being a competitive advantage. So that's very well said, right? So let's end it there, fellas. I appreciate the time this week. And I look forward to next week. Have a good one. Okay.
Many more.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, gentlemen.
All right. Bye.